Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments you can join Jesuit theologian and well-known author Father Gerald O'Collins as he reflects on the resurrection and the empty places in our lives. But first, a couple of features focusing on our two new saints. In the case of St. John Paul II, I'll be shining the spotlight on his Polish roots and legacy, and in the case of St. John the 23rd, on the feeling of sanctity that emanated from him, which some of those who knew him perceived. It's almost a week since Pope Francis canonized two popes of the 20th century, and the Church, as we know, now has two saints, John the 23rd and John Paul II. As announced a moment ago, I'd now like to bring you a very Polish sound picture of this Roman pontiff. Describing moments of joy drawn from prayer, of course, but also from acting, dancing and peripatetic philosophy.
Behold, a Slavic Pope is coming, a brother of the people. Already he pours the world's balm into our breasts, and the angel choirs sweep the throne for him with flowers.
These words were written by the Polish writer Juliusz Żwowacki well over a century before one of his countrymen was elected to the See of Peter. He wrote them in 1848. In those years, Żwowacki may not have been taken too seriously. Not only was he a poet, but he also belonged to the Romantic movement. And at the time, the idea of a Polish pope may have seemed romantic enough. Certainly not a possibility. The papacy had, after all, been the privilege of Italians for over four centuries. So when this loyal son of Poland did become pope, many journalists were floored, among them Arthur Baum, who was standing in St. Peter's Square.
But I was fortunately on St. Peter's Square when the announcement was made. It was one of those wonderful October evenings that you get in Rome. 8 o'clock or so, it was getting dark, dusk. There again, the conclave ended. In that atmosphere, we were told that once more we had a new pope. And we listened intently for his name, Charles. And then came the name Wojtyła. And that left us all completely floored. We thought, someone from Africa? Who could it be? And it took some time for the news to get round that it was actually a man from Poland.
But perhaps to better understand this man from Poland elected as Roman pontiff, one must not only look to the Vatican, but to his roots, to his nation. This may be the most universal of pontiffs, the most media conscious, the most travelled and the most global, but it's still useful to step back in time and find out more about the Polish legacy he brought with him to the Church. A legacy worth a vision, he so often spoke to journalists about himself. For example, he once told an Italian journalist of Polish origin,
I have carried with me the history, culture, experience, and language of my nation. Having lived in a country that had to fight for its existence in the face of the aggression of its neighbours, I have understood what exploitation is. I put myself immediately on the side of the poor, the disinherited, the oppressed, the marginalised, and the defenceless.
Certainly, until recently, it was this public legacy he was perhaps best known for, one which will go down in history books, and one he allowed the world media to abundantly highlight. But there's also a more private part to his life. Penetrating the inner man is not an easy task. As he himself said on one much quoted occasion, They try to understand me from the outside, but I can only be understood from the inside. A remark which is in itself an invitation and a challenge to find out more about this mystical son of Poland, one I'd like to take up for a moment. Striking to me was his very personal approach to suffering in the latter part of his pontificate. One, he had the courage to let the media pry on with their cruel cameras, letting them scrutinise his every physical failing. And one that carries with it perhaps more inner joy than pain, as the pilgrims I put the question, "Do you view the Pope more as a symbol of joy than pain?" picked up on.
Without suffering, we cannot see the joy.
In the suffering, he sees joy.
Well, I think that the Pope would probably be a symbol of joy because he gives people hope.
As this lady highlights, Pope John Paul II may certainly have chafed under the burden of infirmity, but in a world increasingly riddled with the culture of death, his suffering has become a shining beacon of hope. Already since the early days of his pontificate, one of his most striking features was the serenity of his prayer life. His ability to be absorbed in prayer in the public eye, despite the pointed cameras zooming in on him. People close to the Polish pontiff had told me about this striking feature, highlighting it again and again. But the first time I witnessed this personally was at a Marian shrine in Poland. Pope John Paul II prayed and prayed, kneeling in front of the silver icon of Our Lady, said to be miraculous. All the while, the 500 people in the church there and the over 20,000 outdoors were silent. The prayer lasted half an hour, upsetting scheduled plans, and was a lesson for all in itself. It happened in a place by the name of Kalwaria Zebrzydowska, nestling in the Beskidy Hills, a place familiar to him since childhood, given he used to reach it on foot with his father from his town. As his childhood chum, Jerzy Kluger, recounts.
When they were going to Kalwaria with the procession, they were walking all the way.
Yeah, which means a certain closeness. So the young Karol Wojtyła used to go from Badovice.
Yes. He went there very often with his father. He prayed there with his father. His father was deeply religious.
This Marian shrine is a very Polish place, as Pope John Paul highlighted himself, invoking the protection of Our Lady. Grant, O Mother Calvary, that we may be one among ourselves and one with you. A much-needed prayer, the Pope explained, invoking Our Lady's help in granting families, the love which makes it possible to overcome problems, show young people a way to the future. Knows what was on this Polish Pope's mind as he came back to the familiar shrine for the second time in his pontificate. Certainly the closeness to his hometown must have made him nostalgic of his own family, his younger days. Days that, as we know, were marked by personal suffering, by many deaths in his immediate family. And at a more political level, the tragic context of repression he grew up under, first under the Nazi, then under the communist regimes. But suffering never crushed his love for life. There were also happier days, or anyway, happier moments, as Jerzy Kluger describes.
Every year there was a table tennis tournament.
Karol Wojtyła played table tennis?
Yes. He played quite well.
Would you describe the young Karol Wojtyła as a person who was deeply joyful or not?
He was very joyful. His greatest talent, when he was young, was dramatic. You know, his ambition was to become an actor. The way he spoke, this beautiful, you know, voice, you know, the expression, you know, that was his life, you know, his main aim in life. So, obviously, as an actor, he was doing the tragic parts and also comical parts. He was also good at that, very good. And he was very elegant always, you know. Then we had dancing schools and all that. I'm completely unmusical and have no sense of rhythm, so I was just stepping on the feet of those poor girls which were dancing with me. Anyway, he was a very, very good dancer.
A description of normality there for Karol Wojtyła, which may have brought a smile to your face. In reality, expressing a profound ability to embrace life when the sun shines, as in this occasion or indeed in other relaxed occasions, such as the day this Pope and former university professor, reaching out to his Polish roots, enjoyed ambling around in the summer garden in the manner of the Greek peripatetic philosophers, rigorously speaking in his beloved language, with other university professors, such as cosmologist Professor Michael Heller, Polish-born as well.
He invites Polish physicists from Krakow and from other cities of Poland, and we suggested a few times to him that perhaps it should be made international, but he prefers to keep it Polish because it's his vacations, and he wants to use Polish language and to be more free, and devotes 3 or 4 days of his vacations at Castel Gandolfo for such discussions about physics, philosophy, theology, and we discussed cosmology, Big Bang, and particle physics, and philosophy, and chaos theory.
But this ability to embrace life was there on rainy days as well. Days when this frail and elderly man, cooped up in a personal garden of pain, may no longer have been able to speak well, but could still provide a key to reading into suffering. As we watched him in his twilight years, looking stalwartly to the future of old age. A symbol of joy rather than suffering, a symbol of the sacredness of life. Time now to focus on the figure of St. John the 23rd. This 20th century pontiff, who was elected to the See of Peter on the 28th of October 1958. Stay tuned as I bring you echoes of that era with the help of interviews from my personal archive, which include guests such as Cardinal William Wakefield Baum, Monsignor Charles Burns, the late Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili, the late Carmelite Father Redemptus Valabek, the late Ursuline Sister Kathleen England, but also, rather naturally, Vatican Radio archive recordings of his election and recordings of the voice of this much-loved Pope speaking in Italian.
Della Chiesa è innanzitutto espresso dal Papa, ma egli non fa tutto lui.
John the 23rd, oh, a wonderful person. The simplicity of a great saint, I think. I think he was absolutely wonderful. And what he did in 4 years is incredible. Knowing he was a sick man when he started. And I think he was terrific.
Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili put into words the feelings felt by anyone who ever met Pope John the 23rd.
Absolutely wonderful. All the things weren't hoped for happened.
Did you ever have a private audience with him in the Vatican?
Yes, we went to, we asked for a Baciamano, because we were told it was the right thing to do, to ask for an audience. We didn't see why I should waste the poor man's time just chatting to us, so we asked Roberto Mann, what a good compromise, and he was after a great charm and real feeling of sanctity.
Annuncio Vobis Gaudium Magnum Abemus Papam.
On the 28th of October 1958, as a young seminarian, Carmelite Father Redemptus Wallerbeck had joined the excited crowds in St. Peter's Square to hear the name of the new Pope being announced. He recalled how, despite the excitement, the Roman crowds bandied about bewildered comments when they discovered the newly elected Pope was unknown to them and an old man.
Eminentissimum ac reverendissimum Dominum, Dominum Angelum Josephum, Sante Romane Ecclesie Cardinale Meroncalli.
From what I remember, the reason why he was elected is he had a lot of friends among the cardinals. He had been patriarch in Venice, that was his last assignment. See, all those cardinals from the East, as they came to Rome, would have stopped in Venice. The cardinals from Germany and the Central Europe would have stopped there. He was a very hospitable, good person, very open, and the grandfather type. And he was that even with his fellow bishops and cardinals, I'm sure. So that they would have been impressed with that. He knew them and he supported them very much. But don't forget, the rest of his career, too, he would have had connections in France where they knew him to be a very open fellow. He had been in the Balkans, so that he would be given credit, you know, that he would know something of that situation, which in those days was quite critical.
Anyway, he turned out to be a very different pope to the one they expected.
Oh, very, very different, yeah. I think they expected more of a calm, peaceful type of papacy, but think what it is, he realized he didn't have much time. That was my impression. So he seemed to always be going full speed ahead in his own way, you know, not running around, of course, but doing things that we didn't know, we didn't expect him to do.
Qui sibi nomen imposuit Ioannis vigesimi terzi.
I remember that I was in the Caribbean working when John the 23rd was elected. And we looked at each other. We were horrified that Pius the 12th had died, because we thought he was going to live forever, I think. We looked at each other and said, goodness, but this man is 77 or something when he was elected. And someone said, well, he's a transitional pope. And so, as it turned out, he was the great man whom the Lord wanted to throw a bombshell into the church.
When news of John the 23rd's election reached her, Ursuline sister Kathleen England was serving as a missionary right across the world. She too recalled her bewilderment at the election of this elderly pope, swiftly muting into amazement at the speed with which he launched the Catholic Church on one of the most momentous epochs in its history.
As he said, we needed to wake up. We needed to open the windows. As I'm quoting John the 23rd, I don't think anyone can take offence of it. He said, we need to open the windows. And he did. Many people were in his entourage were shocked almost and said, how is this going to be managed? But he managed it.
Why were people shocked? Was that, well, I mean, you know, Second Vatican Council and that for now is history. But then why was it such a bombshell? Why?
Well, nobody expected him to do anything anyway. He was an old man And he was a very simple approach to everything. And they never dreamed that he would do such a thing.
We were all taken aback when we saw how small Pope John was. He seemed a kind of little miniature sort of person in comparison with the figure of Pius XII. This stubby little character seemed a complete contrast with Pius XII.
In those years, Monsignor Charles Burns was studying for the priesthood at one of the pontifical universities.
Two different people. It was still the same world, it was still the same church, but they were quite different people. And certainly what we didn't for a moment suspect was that within 2 or 3 months, when was this? He was elected the end of October of 58. And 25th of January of 59, he calls the Ecumenical Council. Well, that morning, coming down to the Gregorian with all the newspapers, all the headlines, Ecumenical Council called.
Il convenire odierno del Sacro Collegio Cardinalizio, della prelatura e del popolo romano in questa basilica di San Paolo fuori le mura.
He did this on his own. Even his Secretary of State, as far as I know, Cardinal Tardini, didn't know about this. He called this a council when he was out in St. Paul's Basilica on the 25th of January. And it was one of three things that he announced: the revision of canon law, which already was a big thing, then the Synod for Rome, and the Second Vatican Council. And the cardinals were astounded, because I remember one of them thought he was hearing things. He couldn't believe it. They had spoken about a council under Pius XII, but they had decided against it because it was complicated. And of course, you stir up things that sometimes it's better left lie fallow. So they decided against it under Pius XII. And that's why I think they felt if Pius XII, who was an intellectual, couldn't handle it and didn't feel that it was the right time, you know, how would this rather simple man do it? But that was what he called the inspiration of the Spirit. He felt that the Spirit was calling him to do that, to let a bit of fresh air into the church, and to open up windows. And he used that expression, and I think he meant it literally, to open up new venues for the church.
Venerabiles fratres, gaudet mater ecclesia, quod singulari divine providentiae munere, optatissimus iam dies illuxit, quum auspice dei para virgine, cuius materna dignitas odie festu ritu recolitur, hic ad beati Petri sepulcrum Concilium Ecumenicum Vaticanum Secundum Solemniter
truly launched something in the church that has made a great difference. And we're still trying, I believe, to assimilate the council to all of its meaning and its lessons. But certainly Pope John XXIII was a figure of the utmost importance. He was very interested in church history and in the history of thought. I think that's not always understood.
While still a young priest, American Cardinal William Wakefield Baum actively took part in the Second Vatican Council.
Communicate that to us, both before and during the council.
What can you remember about the beginning of the council? Presumably you were there for the opening ceremony.
Oh, yes. It was, of course, overwhelming that the first topic taken up by the fathers of the council was the liturgy. In my naivete, I had not foreseen that. But now, looking back, I see that it was significant and was the right choice to begin with the liturgy. The liturgy is what shapes us. It is so vital in the lives of all the faithful, not just of theologians, teachers, bishops, but of all the faithful. So that we began with the liturgy gave to the council, I'd say, a pastoral tone and significance.
Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti descendat super vos et maneat semper.
Finally, to end this broadcast, a reflection by well-known author and theologian, Jesuit Father Gerald O'Collins.
In Mark's Gospel, on the first Easter Sunday morning, when the three holy women enter the tomb of Jesus, they are told, "He has been raised. He is not here. See the place where they buried him." Yes, see the place where they buried him. Dear friends, our lives are full of people and places that are dead and buried. Some of us have lost both our parents. All of us had dead friends to remember and mourn. At times we go to see where we buried them. There are all those places in Italy, England, Ireland, Scotland, Africa, the United States, the Philippines, New Zealand, Australia, and other countries and continents where we have laid our dead to rest. And there are also the people and places that in other ways have gone out of our lives, never to be seen again. There are the boys and girls we went to school with, the neighbours on the street where once we lived before shifting to another suburb or another city. There are all those people who shared with us for a few years the journey through life, at college, at work, in the same parish, in the same home, along the same street. How few of them have stayed in our lives. Our memory can bring back the places, but the people are gone, many of them forever. Yes, we can see the places where we laid our dead and buried our past. There are so many faces and voices gone out of our lives. But what we can draw from the resurrection of Jesus is the sure hope that none of those faces is truly gone forever, the certain trust that none of those voices will be really silent forever. In Christ, the dead and buried will rise again. None of those faces and voices are finally lost to us in the silence of the grave. Christ died and rose in order to gather into one the children of God who have been scattered. Some of God's children who walk with us have already been scattered and lost in death. Other children of God who are with us for a time have slipped away as we change places. There are all those silent tombs and empty places in our lives. But those tombs and places that have scattered God's children do not have the final say. Like the holy women in the tomb, we hear the words, "See the place where they buried him." But we remember too the words, "He has been raised, he is not here." And we remember also the promise from Jesus to gather into one the children of God who have been scattered. People do go out of our lives, they are laid away in death. But Jesus will come again and take us all to himself, so that where he is, we also may be.
And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.